Yeah. I saw one of my favorite bands of all time is Under Oath.
Sure, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I saw an interview with them years and years ago, and one of their guitar players, he was like, well, the South is never going to rise again, but it's still the best place to live.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of vibe with that.
I grew up and spent a lot of time on the East Coast, and there are things to like here and there, but I live in the Midwest right now. I live in Wisconsin, okay. and the pace of life here is much more similar to the South. Mm. So it's good. We're happy here. Mm-hmm. Where awesome. Are you now, Remy?
North Carolina.
Oh, so that's where my wife grew up. Whereabouts?
Oh, cool. Fayetteville.
Okay, so she grew up in the Raleigh area.
Okay, about 90 minutes northwest. Not 90, maybe 60, 75.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. Nice little day trip you can make. That's the cool thing about Fayetteville, where I live, is there's nothing to do here mm-hmm. at all. But you're never more than like a day trip away. Like Savannah, Georgia, it's like 2.5-3 hours. Okay. Charlotte, 3 hours. The mountains, 3 hours. The beach, 1.5 hours. Like,
yeah, that's cool.
You want to just go somewhere for the weekend, it's boom, it's right there.
Yeah, that's cool. That's one thing I liked when I was in Pennsylvania. I lived a little bit outside of Philly, and it was a similar situation. It wasn't too long to get to New York, wasn't too long to get to D.C., wasn't too long to get to the ocean. So that was right? That was nice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, rock and roll.
So, mm-hmm. Pat, you're a Roman Catholic.
I am indeed, yes, sir, a convert.
Yep. Nice, mm-hmm. nice, nice. How's that going?
Going well, man, by God's grace, right? So I grew up, I was baptized. I grew up in a very nominally religious family. I guess I'll give the condensed version here. But no religious, no good religious formation or upbringing or anything like that. And pretty early on, actually around middle school, I started to have some significant doubts about religion and God and faith and stuff like that. You know, like your typical sort of religion science conflict. I remember I was in sixth grade. I remember it quite well because we started learning about the general sketch of the origins of the universe, Big Bang cosmology, as much as you would impress upon a sixth grader. And I just remember thinking, hey, this doesn't sound like that Adam and Eve story I learned about in the first grade, right? Where's the snake? All this, of course, I had an exceedingly superficial theology at the time. Whatever it was, there's hardly anything there, but it was enough to think like there's two different stories being told here and they seem mm-hmm. incompatible, right? So that was an initial seed of doubt. And just to date myself, I often say that I kind of encountered both of the best arguments, I think, against God at that time without realizing it. And what were they? So in the sixth grade was also when 9/11 happened. So this profound evil happened, right? This profound mm-hmm. evil. So problem of evil. And then also, it seems like the principles of nature, if you will, or science is all we need. So on one hand, God is a sort of unnecessary explanation. And on the other hand, there seems to be this evidence of this great suffering and evil that would contradict or be incompatible with the God hypothesis. So this all happened in the sixth grade. Of course, I wasn't explicit about these arguments, but they sowed a lot of doubt into me, right? And that doubt sort of increased over time. And then by high school, I start getting really interested in philosophy just by the types of people I'm reading. But they get me into philosophy from an old atheist existentialist standpoint. And that was sort of my entry into philosophy and wanting to be a philosopher. So I kind of came in from a naturalistic paradigm, spent many years there. But what happened is the deeper I went into it, the more I tried to better understand philosophical naturalism and try and account for all the data that I think a philosopher needs to account for, the more I realized that that paradigm is horribly inadequate. And so I eventually gave it up. Took a fresh look at some thinkers that I was familiar with, but not intimate with, if I may say so, right? And gradually became convinced of like a perennial philosophy, call it like a big tent Platonism type of thing. Eventually run into this thinker, and theologian known as Thomas Aquinas and many followers of his, right? The Big Tent Thomism. And it was actually a lot of more sort of contemporary Thomistic thinkers that really influenced me. Thought it was beautiful. Thought it was right. Became just generally convinced by the various arguments for God, the background metaphysics, and the systematic unity of the way of seeing the world through that paradigm. Just seemed to be able to answer the types of things that needed to be answered and accounted for. Of course, you can't spend that much time with so many Christian thinkers without also considering Christianity, right?
Sure, sure.
And so I do, and I looked at the basis for it and tried to adjudicate that best I can, and then 4 years ago, I was brought into the church. So that's
amazing.
The very condensed version of all of it, yep. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Yeah, it occurs to me, so I'm gonna sound like a broken record because I mentioned this in a podcast I recorded last night, and I'm going to mention it here again, but I did an interview with a Lutheran pastor named Brian Wolfmuller, and he was talking about we got to talking about sort of pagan religions and how people approach Christianity as though it's paganism, right? Like you see this in movies and stuff, like a horror movie where the priest says the prayer and it doesn't work, and then he's like, "Oh, why isn't it working?" Okay, well, so it's not an incantation. You know, it's not magic. It's, you know, so we were talking about this, and we were talking about how the world is pushing us towards this sort of atheistic naturalism. Like, this is the way all these big thinkers want everything to go. You know, you have guys you know, Tyson and others. But we see, as we've removed Christianity from the culture at large, he made the brilliant point that we don't see people absent Christianity moving to atheistic naturalism.
That's right.
Rather, we see them moving towards Gnostic spiritualism or paganism or witchcraft or these sorts of things, because we're inherently spiritual beings. And I bring this up because it occurs to me that in the realm of apologetics and defending Christianity and these sorts of things, philosophers, I think, have a better grasp on it than, like, the science approach people.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does. So this is something that I sort of struggle with myself, because even though I came from an atheistic, materialistic, philosophical background, I realize that is still a seriously minority position. That is not, atheism has always been an aberration, right? It's not a common, it's just not commonly held either back then or now, right? It's statistically very slim. And especially when you go into the surveys and you really get clear on what atheism is, it's just not very many people, right? So what is the real, sort of post-Christian system of belief is just neo-paganism. It's exactly what you've identified, right? It's a neo-paganism of a kind of, like, weird religious pluralism, not a sophisticated religious pluralism. There are sophisticated forms of religious pluralism that I was actually quite attracted to before I became Christian. I thought I was going to veer in that direction. Like, certain aspects of Hinduism were very attractive to me.
Yeah.
And it can get very sophisticated, and it has some good philosophy and stuff behind it. I still think it's, like, the second best intellectual option.
Yeah,
there, right?
I've said that. I did a world religions class as a part of my, so I'm on track to go to seminary to be a Lutheran pastor.
Yeah, God bless
you. Thank you. So part of that's studying world religions. And I was shocked studying Hinduism, like, in-depth, wrote papers on it and whatnot, and was shocked over and over at just how close they got. So close.
Yep.
And, so close.
Yeah. And so I was veering in that direction for a while. And there's great. I mean, there's very bad and very good philosophy everywhere. But in, Hinduism, you find classical theism, you find good, I think, human philosophical anthropology, all that sort of stuff, right? So I've got a lot of good things to say about that, even if I think that they, it's a little bit off, right? And I have some good friends that are very sophisticated Hindus as well. But that is not, that's not our culture these days. Our culture is right. a very naive sort of religious relativism. I would not consider it a sophisticated religious pluralism. So you're right. Apologetically, that's sort of where I think the focus should be. It's just that my background and my more academic work is more like talking on theism and naturalism. But it's, you're right. right. Not that many people are actually naturalists. They're really not. So culturally, it's just far less significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then, again, I just find the philosophical arguments for God to be much more convincing. And I mean, you know, we can talk about like the fine tuning theory of the earth or whatever, but, at the end of the day, I think it's on the incarnation. That's Athanasius, isn't it?
Yep.
There's a little section in the beginning where he's talking about like life and matter and whatnot. And he says something basically to the effect of like, if everything just came into being, why didn't it just come into being as like anything? You know, like if the universe just happened, why did it just so happen to happen in the way it did and not, you know, some totally arbitrary and useless way, like just a giant like foot popping into existence, you know, or something equally useless, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that goes certainly to Leibniz. This was a big part of my conversion too, is that most of us are, all of us, I'm going to say all of us, I'm going to be bold, right? Are committed to this idea that the universe is actually like, it's actually intelligible, right? That it makes sense, that we can ask questions about it and that we can find answers to those questions. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly what drives science. It's what drives philosophy. But if you're an atheist, what I want to say is at the end of the day, you have to think that answers sort of just arbitrarily stop somewhere, right? That we can ask questions and we get answers, but we're not going to get to something that's sort of intrinsically completely intelligible, that can, if I may follow Bernard Lonergan here, answer the complete set of questions that can be coherently asked about all of reality. Because if you're an atheist, you kind of have to think that natural reality exhausts all of reality, which means realities that are always sort of finite or bounded in some sense, that are always limited in a sense, that point out beyond our limits. Why this shape? Why these set of limits? Why this degree of power rather than some others, right? And you're either going to have to think that all that sort of stuff either came from nothing, which strikes me as too fantastic to even take seriously for more than 2 minutes, or I think more plausibly that it's always been there, right? But if it's always been there, and there's some evidence against that from contemporary cosmology, even though I don't think it's decisive, it still makes sense to ask why it's always been there. It doesn't seem to be able to provide an explanation within itself of why it's always been there and why it's coherently there. Why is it not just anything there at all, but why is it this sequence of things in a coherent way there at all? And that's Leibniz and his principle of sufficient reason. It's not just why are there any contingent beings at all, but why this sequence of contingent beings? Why a coherent, not just why anything, but why coherence, right?
Yeah.
That's not insignificant, right? And what I try to invite people is like, look, it's common. We take it for granted. But what's common is not insignificant. That's one of the most profound things to try and meditate on. And I would think if you meditate on that very, very deeply, like me, you might find that the naturalistic paradigm is really inadequate for trying to make sense of that. Whereas theism, I'll say classical theism, is the only paradigm that I think that can ultimately allow us to affirm that reality is completely intelligible. There is a complete set of answers to the complete set of coherent questions that can be asked, even if we don't have access to those answers right now, which would mean grasping the essence of God, which we can't do in this life anyways, right? Mm-hmm.
So, and it's, I think another big blow to this sort of naturalistic idea of the universe, that there is no God and what have you, another big blow to that, in my mind, is just purpose. Mm-hmm. Like, things clearly have purpose, and you don't develop purpose by chance.
Yes, right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's impossible. Chance is not a thing. Like, chance is a concept that we use to describe events we don't understand, I guess. But it's not like you can't weigh it, or, you know, it's a concept. It's not an actual thing. And as a concept, it can't deliver over purpose. And things have purpose, right? In the universe, in our world, in our own lives, things have purpose.
Right.
And you don't derive purpose from chance.
Right. Directedness, as Aquinas talks about in his fifth way. So even Aristotle talks about chance. He's like, whatever else chance is, it seems to presuppose purposeful direction, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, take the classic example of like a guy mowing his lawn, discovers a box of buried treasure, right? Well, okay, that was a chance event, but that was floating atop on directed causal lines, right? That just happened to intersect, right? So all chance presupposes purpose and directedness, I would say. I'm strongly in agreement with Aristotle there, right? Aquinas is going to say from his fifth way that, look, things have natural purpose or directedness, right? Or teleology, final causality, mm-hmm. right? And he says, take totally unconscious things. The electron is attracted to the proton, right? The acorn is directed towards becoming an oak tree. How is that final cause the pulling cause of all the other causes when it's entirely unaware of its end? The answer is you have to have something that can relate concepts, that can account for mm-hmm. the underlying information states. And right there, we're in the realm of meaning and intelligence. There's no other way to account for this. And Aquinas thinks this is not an argument from, like, design or complexity. It's for Aquinas, it's a metaphysical demonstration about what you're saying, final causality, directness, that requires the relating of it requires conceptual understanding, right? The relating of concepts. And that just is what it means to be in the realm of mind on the fundamental level. So Aquinas is going to say this is an undeniable fact of experience, and it's just a matter of metaphysical necessity that this requires an underlying mind, something that can relate concepts, right? Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I'm strongly convinced of Aquinas' fifth way. I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
What do you think is the strongest argument for God and against God?
Yeah. Very good question. I think. Well, let me start with the other, and then I'll try to reverse it. Right. So I think the strongest argument against God. Well, there's two. It's the two that I've talked about, right? And it's the only two that Aquinas considers when he's considering the existence of God in his Summa Theologia, which is really interesting because Aquinas is, like, well known for often listing tons of objections to positions and then systematically going through those objections. But when he gets to God, he only lists two. He only lists two. Mm. He lists the problem of evil and the God is an unnecessary hypothesis objections, right? And what is the debate today still? It's just those two objections. That's it, mm-hmm. right? Aquinas got it, right? So let's take the second one first, and then we can come back to the problem of evil. I would formulate it like this. If I were, and other naturalists do formulate it like this, you might say something like this. If two theories explain just as much, believe the simpler, theism and atheism explain just as much, atheism is simpler, believe atheism. I think that's probably the best way that I would, if I were to try and push it or steel man it, it would be that. And I would say that the theists can reverse that argument. What they can say is that atheism can only explain some of what theism can explain when strapped with vastly greater complexity. That's what I would say in response. And that would relate to what I think are some of the best arguments for God. And I think that there are metaphysical demonstrations for God. We just kind of sketched one from teleology. Teleology is something that needs to be explained. Why is there directness or purpose? And you cannot mm-hmm. explain that adequately apart from fundamental mentality. But let's switch gears here and maybe go to contingency. There's many beings, as Aquinas would say, that are metaphysically composed, and what that means is that there is a real distinction between their essence, what they are, and their act of existence, right? So, for example, that us, right? We're contingent. There's a part when I did not exist, now I do exist. Clearly, you know, I have an act of existence. I'm present in reality. I can act as you know, a cause on other things. I'm concrete. But there was a time when I did not exist, right? I am, but I need not have been, right? I'm contingent. So Aquinas acknowledges that there are contingent realities, but he actually has an explanation of contingency. Why are things contingent? Well, they're contingent because what they are does not demand or include the fact that they are, right? So something has to impart existence to them, right? So there are these things, no doubt. Now, Aquinas, in a clever way in his De Ante et Essentia, actually first considers a hypothetical. Well, what if something did exist necessarily? What if something were such that its essence just just were to be. Its essence just were identical to existence. And if something were necessary, it would have to be that, right? Its essence would have to be identical to existence, and it couldn't have any differentiating features or parts, because then those parts would be caused, and then it would be uncaused and yet caused, and that's a contradiction. So if something existed necessarily, it would just have to have an essence that is just its existence, right? And he's going to say, since it can't have any differentiating features, it would have to be utterly unique. It would just have to be purely actual, subsistent existence itself. He considers that hypothetically at first. And he says, since it could only be one and only one type of thing, that means in any instance where there's multiples, like where there's multiple people or cats or electrons, they can't be that sort of thing, right? Okay. They have to actually be something whose essence is really distinct from its existence, right? So they must be contingent. And then what Aquinas is going to argue, and this is sort of like the granddaddy of contingency arguments, and I think that it's fundamentally correct, is that when you think about a contingent being, something that is, it doesn't have to be, it doesn't carry a sufficient reason for its existence intrinsic to itself. It always has to have existence imparted to it, not just when it began to exist, but at any time that it exists, right? It's always a dependent being, right? What if that's all reality were? If reality in total were composed of just beings of that sort? Well, then what you have is a situation where everything in reality collectively does not have a sufficient reason for its existence, which means there would be no adequate reason for the existence of anything. There would be no sufficient condition for being. And then you just get a contradiction of fact, right? If there's no sufficient condition for being, then nothing could possibly exist.
Right.
But that's what that hypothesis entails, right? That hypothesis that there's only collectively contingent beings, things that are metaphysically composed with a real distinction between essence and existence, means there just is nowhere a sufficient condition for being, which means nothing would exist. However, we're having this conversation. Things exist, right? So not everything can be like that. There must be something that is not so metaphysically composed, that is not contingent, that is necessary, that does not have a real distinction between its essence and existence, that just is subsistent existence itself. Aquinas runs a very profound metaphysical analysis on what that type of being is. Turns out it would have to be an absolutely ontologically simple, purely actual God of classical theism, right? Mm-hmm. And then, again, this is sort of metaphysically demonstrative. If you have some data, contingent being that needs to be explained, which it does, we have an argument here that shows naturalism cannot in principle explain this, because the only thing that can explain this is this entity that just is subsistent existence itself, which is God. So to my mind, that is demonstrative of the falsity of naturalism. But you could even be more modest and just say, here's something that theism seems to explain a lot better than naturalism does, and for that reason, we should prefer the theistic hypothesis. And then you can get into debates about simplicity as well, because I certainly don't want to grant to the naturalists that their theory is simpler in the relevant respects of simplicity, where it matters most, which I would say is on the sort of fundamental level. So for a theist, we've got one fundamental entity with zero parts, right? And with either one or zero properties, depending on how you understand it. So I don't think a naturalist is ever going to be able to match as fundamental a theory with as much fundamental simplicity, which to my mind is what matters most in the worldview debates as theism. So that's how I begin to counter that, what I think is probably the best case a naturalist could make. Offer your thoughts, and then we could talk about the problem of evil or something from there. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I find it. So this is what I like. This is what I like. That is such a beautiful argument. It's just such a beautiful line of reasoning from start to finish, right? Because I'm following along, I'm listening, and we're talking about contingency, and as I'm listening, I realize, like, along with you, like, as you're saying it, like, it clicks in my head, and I realize, oh, well, if there's not sufficient cause, then, like, nothing would exist. Yet, here we are. Something exists, right? And it's amazing to me that with reason, like, we're able to get there in a fairly concise, easy to understand, like, step by step, here we go, and boom, you're sit here left, like, holding the bag thinking, oh, well, there has to be God, right? Like, here's where we're at. This is the end of this line of reasoning. There has to be God. And it's amazing that we can do that philosophically, like with reason, but like not with science. You know what I mean? Like you can't, right. As you're going over this like sort of thought experiment, I'm thinking what is like on the other end, on the physical end of it, like what's somebody going to do in a lab that can, that can get you to that same point? And there's nothing, right? There's no, there's nothing to test. There's nothing to measure that would get you to that same sort of inescapable conclusion. I don't know. I find that fascinating. I, when it first dawned on me that, that like, that's how like thinking works, a few years ago, I was blown away. I have to credit someone like Cameron Bertuzzi for really pointing that out to me, but.
Oh yeah. He runs a great channel. He runs a great channel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to say a couple things about that because those are some really good thoughts. First is, it surprised me too when I first encountered arguments for God. I mean, like they didn't convince me right away, but like oh wow, these like don't seem entirely idiotic, and I'm not quite sure how to deal with them. And I was never a hostile skeptic, right? So even when I was an atheist or naturalist, like I never had a deep bias against religion. Never had, you know, any issues with religious people. So I wasn't like your nasty atheist. And I think that really helped me because I think when I was able to consider a lot of the considerations for religion, I could kind of do so, I think, quite fairly, right? Without any major emotional bias. And, you know, we always have to check for our biases and prejudices, of course. But I think, at least for me, not having some like deep political hatred for religion or something was a benefit. That when I first started coming across natural theology, which is what we're talking about, you know, philosophical reasoning for the existence of God, I could really just say like, oh, that's interesting, right? Let me look into that more. And, you know, many, many, many years later now, I want to be modest, you know, there's clever objections to these type of arguments. And I spent many years working through these clever objections and stuff like that. And I think, and I've only, in fact, become more confident in the arguments as I've done that. But you brought up the idea of science, and that's right. We shouldn't reduce all-knowing to the scientific form of knowing. That would be scientism, and there's notorious difficulties with that as an epistemology. It's also just a category error. You know, science is physics. It's etiological. It tries to understand how one physical event unfolds into another physical event. What we're doing is ontological. We're asking, why are there any physical events at all? Right.
Right.
So to think that this is a scientific question is just a category mistake. Right. And to say it has to be a scientific question is just question begging. Right. So science is great, but we're just not doing science at this point. Right. And science would have to presuppose to even be coherent many of the things that I think point decisively to God. I have an article that I've written for a volume that talks about explanatory principles and the principle of sufficient reason. And I say, look, if you like science, you should like this explanatory principle because this is sort of needed to undergird all of science and rational inquiry. But as it happens, as soon as you accept this explanatory principle, it's also going to range over all contingent facts, and it's going to give us a necessary being, and that's going to give us theism. So intelligibility, theism, science, I see all these things as inextricably linked. So it's funny because even though originally what brought me away from God was this apparent conflict between science and theism, I'm now firmly convinced that if we want to make sense of science, we better be theists and have the right sort of explanatory principles. Yeah.
Well, it's like the question in mathematics, are we inventing mathematics as we go, or are we discovering mathematics as we go? Right. And that's it's amazing the implication of a single word, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. And it's a little bit of both. Some mathematical things are convention. But of course, I think we're discovering and describing real structural relations quantitatively of the world as well. There's something we're really discovering there. That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So problem of evil.
Yeah. How about that one? Right. Right.
How about that
one? Yeah, so let me talk about this in a couple different ways. There's a number of ways that people sort of deal with the problem of evil, and there's a number of ways that people present the problem of evil, skeptics and theists alike. There's kind of an easy way of dealing with the problem of evil if you think what I just said is correct, right? So if you think what I just said is correct, that there are metaphysical demonstrations of God, then you can legitimately say something like this. Look, reason seems to reveal to me that God exists, And with other certain principles, I can know that God is purely actual and perfectly good. You know, principles like the convertibility of being in goodness and stuff like that. That God has no privations, no lacks, no wrinkles, no defects. So he really is perfect being itself, right? Mm-hmm. Well, then I can just say that God exists and evil and suffering occurs. And if two things are actual, they must be compatible. So what's the problem? Right? And that's just the end of it. If you think that there are metaphysical demonstrations for God, right? And then you don't deny that suffering and evil occur. And you just have to say that, yeah, both of these things are in fact the case. And if they're both the case, they must be compatible. And if they must be compatible, they can't be incompatible. So there you go. God and evil must go together for some reason, even if I don't see what it is, right?
Leaning on kind of a mystery there.
You could, but I'm just saying
it's not. If they both exist, they're both compatible, and even if I don't understand that compatibility, it must be true.
It must be the case, right? So you could take a Mysterian approach there and say, look, reason tells me this, experience tells me that. This is just what it is, and I could leave it with that and not be like an intellectual fraud. I think that's a legit position, right?
As a Lutheran, that's like the core of like all of our theology, right there.
Just Mysterianism.
We lean a lot on. We're with you in the body and blood in the sacrament. It truly is the body and blood of the Lord. We're not with you on how or why.
Yeah, right? You guys have.
I
would love to talk and hear more about it, because my understanding is Lutherans don't hold a real absence, whereas Catholics do when it comes to transubstantiation. Correct.
So you're saying it's no longer bread and wine at all.
Right.
Right.
Like, there's a fundamental substantial. Yeah.
Right.
Transubstantiation.
Yes.
Correct. Yeah. Yes, so there are technical differences, right? Yeah.
Yes. If you were to ask me, is it bread and wine or is it the body and blood of Christ? I would just say yes.
Yeah. Right.
It is
yeah.
those mm-hmm. things. Yes.
Right. Yeah. So we can, that's,
you know, yeah. how, why, who knows? Not my mm-hmm. problem. Jesus right. said the thing. I believe the thing. We move on.
Right. So the point and this is a really good point, is I think you can be a principled Mysterian in many mm-hmm. areas, right? And a Mysterian means like, I know this is true. I know this is true. And maybe I don't see how they fit together, but I know that they must fit together. And there's no contradiction. So, right, as long as you remove the idea that there's a contradiction, you know, I think you have at least an obligation to do that. And that's what Aquinas did for many things, right? Sometimes people mm-hmm. get like a little disappointed with Aquinas when he's talking about the incarnation, because he didn't show how it works. He just showed that it's not contradictory. But that's doing a lot of work, right? Because it's not contradictory. Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that do I absolutely need to understand this? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like there are some things that like you just don't need to understand necessarily. I mean, you can poke at things if you want, but you know, like the Eucharist, we would say you don't really need to dive that deep into it. Just he said it, believe it, move on, you know. And right. again, problem of evil, you know, God exists mm-hmm. and bad things happen. Now, just because I can't see how two things are compatible mm-hmm. Doesn't mean they contradict. Yeah. And, you know, like you said, as long as I can accept that, you know.
As long as you, so yeah, let's go further. I just wanted to get that point on the table because I think it's not illegitimate. And, but I'll grant, like, maybe people don't find that entirely satisfying. I think it's true, but I don't think everyone will be super satisfied with that. So let's go further, right? So problem of evil, there's kind of like two variants, right? There's the strong form called the logical problem of evil, and then there's more of the evidential form. And the latter arose because I think most philosophers these days realize that there really is no good logical problem of evil. And the logical problem of evil wants to claim that there is a strict incompatibility between God and evil, right? There's like a contradiction in there somewhere. Mm. But the problem is nobody's really been able to draw that contradiction out. So most philosophers, including most skeptics, have sort of given up this stronger form of the problem of evil. And look, as soon as you do that, then what I just said before is free and clear, right? Because if there's really no contradiction, then there's no reason to think that these two things are strictly incompatible. And if you have reason to think that they're both actually the case, then there you go, right? So that's not an insignificant concession by skeptics to see that they've moved more towards the evidential problem evil. Now, to be fair, every once in a while you get a skeptic who tries to resuscitate the logical problem evil, but I think it always runs into the same problems, is they can't really show what the contradiction is. They can't really ultimately show that God couldn't have good reasons for allowing the suffering and evil of our experience, right? So what they do instead is they say, well, look, either any suffering or evil at all, or the types, or the amounts, the quantity, the quality of the suffering and evil, it counts as evidence against the God hypothesis, right? That's the way they see it. They see it as an evidential weight. And in consideration with other evidence, right? And depending on who you're talking to, they might think it's a very big weight. They might think it's a completely decisive weight. If you're a skeptic, like, I don't know, like Paul Draper or something, just thinks it's just so forceful. Others might think it's just a little weight, right? And in fact, you even have certain theists that will say, yeah, it counts as a bit of an evidential weight against theism. But when we weigh up all the other evidence, you mentioned fine-tuning and all the arguments from consciousness and all this or that, then the scales are still decisively tipped in favor of theism, right? So that's another way that people think about it. I'm not so gracious. I think suffering and evil actually points quite decisively towards God, and I think all the weight is in the theistic scale. Hmm. But it takes a bit of work, I think, to show how that is. So I don't know if you had any initial thoughts on any of that, or we can just keep rolling with this.
No, I have some very non-philosophically trained thoughts that I would like to dump maybe a little later that I'm still kind of formulating.
Yeah, so think of it this way, right? So one way to think about it, and this goes back to the nature of metaphysical demonstration, right, is that evil itself, our judgment of evil, actually has a lot of entailments, right? To even get to the judgment of evil entails that there's something exists, right? Obviously, that there are conscious beings, conscious rational beings, arguably with moral knowledge and stuff like that. And what I want to say is that the evidential impact of any particular thing is always incomplete without considering its entailments, right? So if A entails B, then the evidential impact of A is always incomplete without considering the evidential impact of B. But if say if our judgment of evil entails that there are conscious beings with moral knowledge, and conscious being with moral knowledge can only in principle be explained by theism, and naturalism is already probability zero because of conscious beings, then the overall evidence of evil cannot possibly count as evidence against theism when widening the scope of entailments, if that makes sense, right? Because you wouldn't even get to the judgment of evil if naturalism were true, because you couldn't clear the barriers on the way, whether it's being in general, conscious entities, reasoning conscious entities that have moral knowledge. And moral knowledge is a big issue, I think, for naturalists to account for. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that kind of points to sort of the presuppositional end, which I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of, but I like the idea that the moment you start talking about moral knowledge, now you have to account for morality. You can't have moral knowledge without a moral standard, and you can't have a subjective moral standard and then argue that the evil in the world outweighs God. I don't think it, because like, well, who are you to decide what is evil?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of ways to think about this. I'm trying to take, I think, what I think is the safest route. And that's why I'm focusing on consciousness. Cause I think that you have, especially when it comes from intentionality and formal thinking, I think you have, again, metaphysical demonstrations against a materialist, physicalist, naturalist worldview from that, which means naturalism cannot, in principle, get to this point, but you need to get to this point if you ever want to have any experience of evil. You see what I'm saying? Right. So there's an in principle barrier there. Do I think that naturalists can account for moral facts, moral realism? At the end of the day, no. But I at least want to say there's a lot of naturalists that try. So if the theist wants to make their job a little bit easier, maybe stay away from that, because they'll throw out, I mean, naturalists will sometimes bring in like Platonism and try and hold to like a Platonic view of moral facts, and they've got stuff. Now, what I'll say is that naturalism properly considered with Darwinism should cause you to be a moral anti-realist, because what Darwinism and naturalism should do is cause you to think that morality, like you said at the beginning of this conversation, is actually something we invent, not discover. And I would say that you're really kind of going against your own tradition and train of thinking if you're a naturalist and a moral realist. You have a really hard time not only grounding moral facts, but if you're a naturalist and you think that moral facts sort of supervene upon natural facts, well, then what Darwinism in conjunction for naturalism should do is cause you to doubt that dependence thesis is true in the first place, right? That you've really discovered something, that you've actually invented something. That's what it should cause you to do. Mm-hmm. Naturalists will push back against that. Obviously, I don't think it's a tenable position, but I'm just trying to skirt around complicated issues because I don't think they're essential to the point I'm trying to make. Then there's moral knowledge, which is different from moral facts, because there could be moral facts, but we could never know of those moral facts, right? So moral mm-hmm. knowledge is a different category that we have to account for. And then naturalists have an even greater difficulty here, because if all of our sort of beliefs and knowledge, which I don't think really makes sense on a naturalistic paradigm, especially if you're a determinist, but whatever, let's just grant some stuff for the sake of argument. Why should we believe that evolutionary processes guided us to the right moral facts, especially when we consider Darwinian mm-hmm. counterfactuals, or the way that evolution could have shaped us to have different moral beliefs, right? Why should we think that it landed on just the right ones, just the right sort of
right.
platonic forms of morality? Like, it seems, this is important, a totally unreliable process. And knowledge cannot be based upon that unreliable of a process and still be called knowledge, moral facts. So this is getting into other arguments, but I think naturalism yeah. has major issues across the board with explaining any of this, right? But your points are good ones, but that's just how I would start to detail some of those. But even if the naturalist wants to say that they're an immoral anti-realist, we still have judgments about evil. They would just say that those judgments are false. I'll say, fine, fair. You're still not even going to get to that point unless you have conscious beings online, and naturalism can't even get there, right? So either way, like, you're not. I don't think they're gonna have much going for them from the problem of evil if you think that there are, prior to our experience and considerations of evil, in principle points that naturalism cannot get beyond, right? Because even if you thought that the probability of God creating a world of suffering and evil was low, right, just considered by itself, I don't think it is. But even if you thought that was the case, what's important is the ratio between the two. Okay, but how low is it on naturalism that we would have these experiences? And I'm saying it's probability zero, right? Mm. And it's the ratio between the two that matters. So even if you thought it was low on theism, that's better than zero. And in which case, the fact that we have this experience at all cannot possibly be evidence against theism from that perspective. But I want to go even further. I tend to be kind of a bold, aggressive guy in some of this stuff. But the more I've thought about it, the more I've become more convinced that this is actually fundamentally correct, and my boldness has increased. The more I've really thought about this and read, I think, the best naturalists and skeptics. Right. So let's just grant the naturalists that they can actually account for things that I think they can't account for. Let's say they can get being online, they can get consciousness online, all that stuff. Let's grant. All right, well, now we have to compare that there are conscious beings that suffer versus that there are conscious beings that don't suffer, and we ask, well, what would we more likely expect if theism were true or naturalism were true? And the naturalist would probably want to say, well, look, it just seems like a worldview that's run by a fundamental principle of indifference better explains the suffering and evil that we experience than a worldview that's run by a fundamental principle of perfection. That's really the difference between theism and atheism, right? One worldview thinks that the fundamental reality is perfect. Another thinks that fundamental reality is run by a principle of complete indifference, right? That's it. Well, I want to say that the suffering and evil, even if you take it from that comparative viewpoint, still favors theism. Now why? This is where it takes more unpacking. This is why I wanted to start with like the simple points first and kind of go from there. Well, think about it this way. If you're a naturalist, it actually seems like there's a great range of ways that we could have experienced either more or less suffering and evil, or even none at all. Just think about that, right? Yet the suffering and evil that we experience seems to fall just within a range that is quite conducive for redemption and soul building. Isn't that interesting? I mean, it just seems like it could have been the case that we could have had a world so suffused with so much suffering and evil that as soon as conscious beings came online, they just all committed suicide, right? That suicide was the rule rather than the exception of despair. Or that our qualitative experience of pain is actually sort of functionally redundant on naturalism, because all that matters is the sort of physical processes underneath. Why do we have to have this higher level awareness of pain? It's just the physics that matters, right? So what, like, it could have just been that there's no qualitative experiences of pain on naturalism, even with surviving entities. That seems like another way that things could have gone. In fact, that seems to be the way that things should have gone if naturalism were true, right? Or maybe it could have just been that there's just the occasional mosquito bite, and that's about as bad as it gets, but nobody really learns any important lessons from suffering. Nobody builds any, like, virtuous character from suffering. But what's the kind of world that we live in? Well, we live in a kind of world where people, enormous number of people, actually overcome horrendous suffering and become saints and heroes because of it. There's soul building. This is going back, of course, to Irenaeus, right? Soul building theodicies, redemption. We seem to fall within a certain range of the way that suffering and evil could have occurred that's just right for redemption and soul building. And I want to say that's the sort of thing we would expect if God exists. It's not the sort of thing we would expect if God does not exist. And we would expect this if God exists, I think, for a couple of reasons. And this is where I think good philosophy of God and philosophical anthropology helps a lot. God is perfect. Only God is the subsistent good itself, the standard that you've talked about, right? So in classical theism, we hold that, that being and goodness are convertible. God is subsistent being. God is subsistent goodness. God's sort of reason for creating, we want to say, following Jacques Maritain, is to have friendships, love, and communion with his creatures, to share his goodness with us, to communicate his goodness with us, right? But if God's going to have friendships, love, and communion with beings like us, he's got to create beings with independent free wills, right? Now, here's an important metaphysical difference. Only God's will is perfect, because only God's will is identical with the good itself. Any other will that God brings online is a fallible will. It's a will that could always not consider the moral rule in some particular instance. It's an act potency composite. It's a being with liberty, but a fallible liberty. Our freedom is different than God's freedom. People need to understand that. God is impeccable. We're peccable. We're creatures that could make moral miscalculations, as Boethius says. Okay, but if God wants to communicate his goodness and share his love and intimacy with us, you have to have, you can't have love without two wills. You can't have it. Doesn't make sense, right? So that means that God has to create beings with wills that could fail and that obviously did fail. Could God give graces to all the beings like us all the time to always make the morally right choice? Yes, God could, but I would say God doesn't, because God is a perfectly wise governor. He works with things according to their mode of being, right? Otherwise, he's just sort of running miracles all the time. And then what's the point of nature? There's no point. It's, right. And God isn't in the business of nonsense. So in the general run, granting that miracles and exceptions can occur, in the general run, he's going to guide things according to the sort of thing that they are. We are fallibly free beings. We could fail. We do fail. We have failed, right? Original sin, all that story, right? However, God permits this, one, because it's in accord with who we are, and two, God can bring greater goods from it. He can bring things like redemption, incarnation, atonement, other really important virtues, other what we might call logically dependent goods. Logically dependent goods are things that can only happen in certain circumstances, like courage can only happen when there's risk and danger, empathy and compassion only when other people suffer. These are really good goods, right? And people realize that. So God aims for love. Love entails bringing other free creatures online that could fail, that have failed. God permits it because it's in accord with who we are. It's good. And he can bring even greater goods, an even better world from it, ultimately. And that suffering, importantly, has really medicinal purposes for us, right? Helps us to relinquish ideas of false notions of independence, helps bind us in moral community, helps us to grow in different virtues, endurance, empathy, compassion, mercy, all that sort of stuff, right? And the fact that we find ourselves in a world that seems to be just right for redemption and soul building, where saints arise, where we live in a world where actual saints arise, is amazing, because that's just the sort of thing you would expect if God exists. It's not at all the sort of thing you would expect if naturalism were true, where it could have gone in so many different ways. Because I think we can say that if suffering and evil occurs with God, it's going to be within a certain range, right? Now, the atheist, let me just get one more thing and we'll get you, I want you to chime in. The atheist will say, well, there's gratuitous evils. There's evils that are undefeated, that can't be justified. And what I want to say to that is there's really no evidence of this. The most we have is that it seems like some people maybe apparently haven't defeated evil in this life. But if theism entails an afterlife, then the claim to gratuitous evils is, again, always question begging, right? It's always just going to be assuming the thing that you're trying to prove. And what we do have evidence of is in this life of tons of people, really countless people, overcoming even incredible evils and becoming saints of it. That we actually do have evidence of. So what I want to say, the point I'm ultimately trying to make, is upon substantial analysis, no matter how you want to run the comparisons, evil and suffering is actually better evidence for God than away from God. What do you think of all that? Does that sound right to you?
That you blew my mind. You just blew my mind. I'm going to, at the end of this, when we're done recording, I'm going to ask you for a book list of things to read.
Sure.
I really like your view of free will.
I call it the soft free will defense.
Yeah. That's good. I like that. And that dovetails nicely with our own theology, my own theology. Anyway, I really like that. Towards the last thing you were saying, people saying undefeated evil exists, but even not assuming an afterlife, there is no undefeated evil, right? Because everyone dies, right? Which is sort of the defeat of everything. Even if you have someone who does commit great evil, they never repent, and they get away with it their whole life. At the end of the day, they're still going to die, right? Like, does that make sense? Is that dumb?
Yeah. It depends. I think it depends how you look at it. What atheists and skeptics are going to claim is when they say undefeated evil, they're really meaning the evil that isn't or couldn't be justified in a sense, like morally justified. And that I'm saying is always going to be question-based, because the worst that we have of the evidence that we have is just that apparently some people just haven't defeated it in this life, meaning it hasn't seemed to be justified in this life. But I, of course, hold that theism entails an afterlife, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
that even just basic thinking of the human person on a physical level gives us that as well. So, yeah, depending how you think of it, or depending how you interpret the word defeat, I could see how you could think of it as the way you did as well, which is an interesting consideration.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I want to bring up that I think is funny, and this is not super philosophically deep at all. I just think it's hilarious that you will have your rabid atheist, right? Mm-hmm. Who absolutely does not under any circumstance believe there's any kind of God. And they, for some reason, spend all day yelling at Christians on Twitter, which is exactly, I am a rabid, Easter Bunny denier, and so I spend all my free time yelling at people about the Easter Bunny, because that's a whole rabbit trail I could go off on. But you could have the most rabid atheist in the world, and I find it funny that they will say that going all the way back to contingency and all that, they'll tell you it's all bunk, that everything just happened, there was an infinite singularity, and then something, and here we are, and it's all whatever. But then, those same people will absolutely gush over something like simulation theory, right? Where we're all just a simulation of a highly advanced race, which, again, itself, I think that also just begs the question, right? Because okay, so we're all just a simulation of some highly advanced race, but wouldn't they then have the same, okay, you've explained us, but now them,
yeah, you're good, because I think you're pointing out legit inconsistencies. Now, let me be fair to some of my atheist friends, right? I mean, I guess what they might say in terms of the reason we don't rail against the Easter Bunny is because it doesn't make any real political differences in the world, and they think they need to rail against God and religion because they think it's promoting political evils or something like that. So,
okay, all right.
Fair enough. Now, whether that's the real motivation or there's just some sort of deep other personal hatred there, I don't know. I try not to do too much armchair psychoanalysis, right? Too much. I give myself one of those a day, right? But the other point, yeah, there's just a lot of funny inconsistencies like that. People are like, there's no evidence of any sort of intelligence beyond our existence at all when they're thinking or debating the existence of God. But and then 5 minutes later, they'd be like, oh, yeah, the simulation hypothesis makes tons of sense, which is
right.
Claiming there's intelligence, right? There's somewhere, right, behind our existence. I pointed this out in an interview I did with Catholic Answers when I was actually refuting the simulation hypothesis and responding to a video by Neil deGrasse Tyson. But I mean, you're right. At least the traditional arguments for God, like, they're unaffected by this. Even if we were in a simulation, well, it's still contingent, still requires an extrinsic explanation, right? It's just,
right.
It's
all
a
we're
kind
doing
of a
is
weird way, yeah.
Moving it, just moving it back one.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
you're kind of you're launching the argument from God from a rather weird skeptical point, but it doesn't derail it ultimately.
Right.
Right. So it's sort of irrelevant there. I think there's other epistemological issues and often self-defeat issues with things like the simulation hypothesis. But the point you're pointing out is a good one. It's just that many skeptics are just very inconsistent. On the one hand, they'll totally deny any notions of intentionality or purpose or design in the world, and then totally affirm it in another context. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Anything that would be philosophically an evidence for God, they will reject. But if you say it's an evidence for a computer program by a highly advanced sentient alien race, then they're like, oh, yeah, absolutely.
That sounds great. Right.
Yeah. But see, so I am going to do some Monday morning quarterbacking here and some armchair psychology. I am going to go for it.
It's your podcast,
I think the reason,
you do whatever you want.
I think the reason people are so willing to do that, though, and live with that inconsistency there is because a highly advanced sentient alien race that has created us all as a part of a computer simulation won't ultimately judge you and send you to hell.
Ooh, yeah. This kind of helps you to make sense of some data you think really needs to be made sense of, but without having any sort of real strong moral challenges to life. Is that
correct?
Is that
without
right?
having any real responsibility. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of it. I think even your most rabid atheist, I think at the core of it, it's all to escape judgment. Because I mean that's the first thing Adam and Eve did was they hid from God in the garden. They hid away. And then when God called them out and said, where are you? They put on fig leaves to try and hide their sin. So first they try and hide from God. Then they try and hide their sin. And at the end of the day, that's what we do. We run from the judgment of God that we know is coming. And the only real salve, the only real balm for that particular wound is Christ, is knowing that that judgment was handed down to him in our stead, right? That's the rub. That I think, and that's why I would say that people do rail against Christianity on the internet so much. And they can say we're fighting political evils because the right to murder your unborn child is important for some reason. But at the end of the day, what they're really railing against is the judgment of God that they don't want to face.
Yeah, you know, I can...
That's my thought.
Since I've already taken advantage of my one armchair psychoanalytical speculation for the day, I'll just talk from my experience, and I'll say, look, you know, a lot of what gets detailed is my, you know, my, I guess my intellectual process to Christianity. But this is something I struggled with too, man. I mean, I was not living a saintly life before my conversion. And it became very clear and very obvious to me that if I thought this was true, that if I kept living the way I was, that I was being very inconsistent with it. And that was not an easy thing. And I would not be honest if I didn't say that there were multiple layers of resistance on that level. So in one sense, even though I didn't have any strong political bias or animus against religion, there were just deep, straight up sinful tendencies for me, right? That... I either didn't want to give up or didn't think it would even be possible to give up. But by God's grace, I will say by God's grace and day by day, obviously I am where I am at this point. But just sharing my personal history and experience, that was not an insignificant hurdle, obstacle, difficulty that I myself had to wrestle with quite a bit, you know? So I'll just put myself out there.
Always good. Yeah. Always good. Mm-hmm. Pat, thank you for being here, man.
Hey, man, this was a treat for me, and I really appreciate you having me on. This was a blast, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I personally enjoyed you're a lot smarter than me, which is fine. I love it, but I never felt lost. You're very good at explaining things. You're very good at teaching. I don't know if anybody's ever told you that. But I was just right with you the whole way.
Well, thank you. I do try to take, you know, I'm very much inspired by a guy, a philosopher that I admire very much, Mortimer Adler, and his whole thing was, he had a slogan called "Making Difficult Thought Easy," and I always admired how he would present his ideas because it was clear that he was a man who was extremely well studied, had a command of the issues, but could present them in a clear, articulate way. And to me, that was inspiring because, yeah, I mean, I think that shows that you actually do have a command of the issues. If you can't, you know, articulate things in an intelligible, accessible way, I mean, how well do you really know them? So anyway, it's very flattering, and it's very gracious of you to say that because it's something that I do try. I do try to make an effort.
You do a good job.
Thank you so much.
What can we promote for you? There's gonna be at least 12 people that listen to this.
Yeah. Well, I would love to appeal to all of them. Most relevantly would just be my channel, Philosophy for the People, over at YouTube. And on iTunes, I have a podcast called the very humbly and originally named The Pat Flynn Show. And the iTunes podcast is generalist. I do a fair amount of philosophy and some theology, but I also do like stuff on fitness and stuff like that. But the YouTube channel, Philosophy for the People, is exactly that, you know, just a lot of philosophy. We're doing a series on Aristotle. We did a series on Plato. We did a series on Aquinas' Principles of Nature. Bring on a lot of guests to talk about different issues. Focus a fair amount on philosophy, religion, and stuff like that as well. So if people enjoyed this conversation, they'll probably find some stuff to like over there.
Okay. Very cool. And I'll leave links to everything in the description. I have to ask, the Pat Flynn Show, there's another Pat Flynn.
There is. Fake Pat Flynn. Fake Pat Flynn, we call him.
Oh, he's fake Pat Flynn. You're real Pat Flynn. Yeah. Because he also, I think, has a podcast called The Pat Flynn Show.
Yeah, funny story. I was actually just on that podcast. And the episode I did with him should be airing in June because we constantly get mixed up with each other, even though we live in completely different worlds. In fact, not entirely, because I have this book out, which a lot of people think is his book, but it's actually mine. So he gets tagged in that a lot.
Nice.
And he's very gracious. He always, you're talking about smart passive income Pat Flynn. I'm not that Pat Flynn.
No.
I'm not that Pat Flynn. He's a really nice
guy. He's a great Pat Flynn.
He's a great Pat Flynn, really great guy. And people can maybe look forward to that podcast I did with him on his podcast, which he says will be out in June sometime, where we just like clear the air and show there are two Pat Flynns. They're not the same person. Here's the differences, right?
Yeah. That Pat Flynn. There's North Korea and false Korea. That's how they do it over there. The North Koreans. So, false Pat Flynn. He got me into podcasting. It was following all his advice and all this stuff. I said, you know, I should do a podcast. So,
yeah, that's his wheelhouse. So, He's good guy, good dude. He's to be fair, even if we call him false Pat Flynn, he's definitely the more popular Pat Flynn on the internet.
Yeah.
So
Very cool. Well, Pat, thank you so much, brother.
Thank you, brother. Really enjoyed it.